Hey, just so you know, this episode and all other episodes contain some foul language here and there. Nothing really super objectionable, like we don't say cunt a lot, but, you know, you've been warned. Thank you.
Listen to my daddy and my Uncle Jay, not in a creepy way.
Hi-ho, Eric D. Podcaster here, you know.
That's my everlasting memory of that film. Not the film, but my ass getting blistered from the seat.
And that's the sound of a joke just falling flat.
That's okay. I like this podcast.
Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1976 thriller, All the President's Men, directed by Alan J. Pakula.
And Robert Redford.
Well, kind of. He produced it, and he actually, you know, he bought the rights to it for $500,000.
And, you know, in all fairness, some history to this, you know, this movie, of course, I was 4 years old when this movie came out. So I don't have any real memory of the movie. I watched it probably in high school in my bedroom of our parents' house, probably at like some really super late night, like 11 p.m. to like 2 in the morning movie thing. So it was edited, heavily edited, because, you know, there's some foul language in here. What with the rat fucking and the hey. So I have fond memories of this movie, but this is absolutely one of my most favorite movies. And even rewatching it, I still enjoy it from start to finish.
Oh, me too. It's a great movie, and it's 2 hours long.
And it's longer than that.
It's lots of telephone calls and head scratching, and there's no love interest to the movie, and yet it's well paced through the whole thing. I'm so impressed by this movie. Does not have like slow moments, really.
No, there's not much slack. There's also not a lot of score to it. I mean, there's some music and some tension, but it's very orchestrated music. It's not, you know, there's not a lot of there's not like a modern movie soundtrack to it, which I really appreciate.
There's a little trivia to that. The score, the actual score of it, doesn't start until 25 minutes into the movie.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The first part of the movie is very kind of like, I also want to observe that there are moments in this movie where Jason Robards looks, he and Dad could be doppelgangers.
Oh, that's funny.
There were just a couple moments where he had, between the hair and the look on his face and the kind of the facial expressions, I'm like, that's Dad.
Oh, wow. That's high praise indeed for our father, because Jason Robards, I don't know, in my notes I put, is there an actor with a better, with more gravitas than Jason Robards? The answer is no.
Well, and in watching it, when you and I are going back and rewatching this, I try and be a little more critical, and I'm trying to be a little more, you know, a little more analytical about the movie, because normally I would just watch this movie, and I would just watch this movie. It would just be, it wouldn't be anything that I would, it wouldn't be a higher brain functioning effort to watch this movie. And of course, I've seen it countless times. But, you know, in watching it last night, or not live, I actually watched it Sunday, I was struck. I'm just like, you know, he has some real facial expressions that, like, it reminded me verbatim of Dad. It just totally dialed me in. So there were moments where it gave me chills.
Oh, that's funny. I'm going to have to rewatch it again with that in mind. Because this is a movie I'm going to rewatch. It's just fun. I mean, it's not sneakers. It's a whole different kind of movie, although Robert Redford.
Well, it's kind of a pre-modern sneakers. A little bit. I mean, there's no espionage and there's no surveillance per se, but, you know, there's some good sleuthery in here.
Oh, there is espionage and surveillance. You just don't see it because it's on the other side.
Well, that's true. But had you not seen this movie before?
Oh, no, I've seen the movie, and I've read the book a couple times. In fact, I've been listening to the book for the last couple nights, because the book is a very well-written book, although the movie only covers part of the story. This is not a movie about Watergate. This is a movie about the Watergate story.
Right. This is a movie about Woodward and Bernstein.
Exactly.
And I appreciate that as such. So I need to go and I need to. So is the book on Audible?
It is. Yes.
So I need to go and get that because I got my credit today.
Oh no, it's
God, well Audible
worth
needs
listening.
To give us some goddamn plugs, by the way.
I know.
So
I know. Well, So far, the call to actions for our listeners hasn't resulted in any, I don't know, emails. However, someday we'll get our Audible, what is it called, partner agreement, where you can go to www.audible.com/notcreepy and get yourself 2 months free.
Yeah.
Or two free books or a free book or whatever they offer. But either way, audible.com.
Yeah. But yeah, this is one of the movies on my
list of judgment.
I like political thrillers. I like political movies. And it's funny, though, to go back and watch just how young, realize how young the actors were then, of course, but just the surroundings and, you know, the monuments and the buildings and the artifacts that were around them. And but also, you know, I don't know how accurate the movie portrayal is, you know, because obviously there's a lot of embellishment and drama just built into the screenplay, but it makes me wonder how true to the story the movie was.
I think it's pretty accurate. Have you seen pictures of Woodward and Bernstein from the day?
Yeah.
Okay, because Robert Redford doesn't really look anything like Bob Woodward, but Dustin Hoffman looks exactly like Carl Bernstein. He looks exactly like him. It's incredible. But anyway, do you know anything about the director? I didn't. When I read the name, I'm like, Alan Pakula. Well, I've never heard of him.
I do not.
Turns out he wrote Sophie's Choice.
Oh.
And he also wrote the screenplay for Presumed Innocent and The Pelican Brief. And he directed Clute, The Parallax View, which someday we'll have to do The Parallax View. That's a good movie. This movie, of course. Let's see. What else? Sophie's Choice, Presumed Innocent, The Pelican Brief, The Devil's Own. Like, he's a quality guy. Wow. He was nominated for an Academy Award for this. And I thought it was so well done as far as, like I said, this is a thinky kind of movie. This is a movie about two reporters basically talking on the phone to people and showing up at people's houses.
Well, and badly.
Well, yeah. And so there's, you know, but there really is tension in this movie. And they carry it through the whole thing. It's great.
Well, and there's some scary parts in this movie where, I mean, granted, there's no gunshots and there's no craziness. But I remember watching this movie the first time and being scared when seeing Robert Redford looking scared. And so there's a lot of just electricity in this movie that's just kind of finding an outlet. I'm looking at the budget. So $8.5 million budgeted, grossed $70 million.
Oh, I know.
That's just incredulous.
Okay, Ray Romano. It's actually more incredible. You're incredulous. Anyway, sorry. There's a whole in
you
Ray Romano.
Really, just compare me to Ray Romano.
Well, Ray Romano has a whole joke about incredulous.
I know. Okay. I may never forgive you for that.
No, that's okay. I'll take it out in post. Anyway, it's just incredible what they did with that budget and the fact that the amount of detail in this movie. I mean, we'll get into it, but they were wicked focused on detail.
Well, and it looked like it, and I made some notes about some of the details because, like, there was some definitive product placement because, you know, like, there's this box of Ritz crackers that keeps popping up.
I saw that. I thought, did they have product placement back then? Maybe so.
Yeah, and then McDonald's kept popping up.
Yeah. And you wonder, you know, maybe I'm naive, but maybe it's just, you know, the Ritz crackers seem like that's definitely a Procter & Gamble kind of thing, or Nabisco, or whatever, whoever owned it at the time. But McDonald's may have just been what they ate, you know, who knows? I guess they could have thrown Burger King in there instead.
Well, and you know, there's a part in the movie where, you know, Woodward is having his breakfast, and he's, like, unwrapping, like, what looks like a lemon zinger pastry, which is one of the little hostess cake things. So... you know, it was just funny to see all of that. Yeah. But not the least of which is, by the way, also rotary phones with the giant Lucite clear plastic buttons for the lines.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, a throwback. Doesn't happen anymore, but...
Well, all that stuff, even the food is all, you know, now it's historical.
Right. And the bicycle tire that just kept appearing in everybody's cubicle at the newspaper.
Well, that was his bicycle tire. That was Bernstein's. He actually rode a bike a lot. That was just part of his thing, although they didn't really talk about it in the movie.
You never see him on a bike, ever.
No, but that's part of him. That's part of him.
Yeah, but, like, the tire wasn't always in his cubicle, though. It kept migrating around.
Oh, you think?
yeah, there's a couple spots where it's, and maybe it's obliquely put in different areas just kind of to be kind of an anecdotal reference, but, you know, I kept noticing this tire was in different positions.
Well, but that's funny.
At no point do they ever, there's never any explanation as to what the significance of the tire is, which may have just been one of those small attentions to detail that somebody was lending itself for the, you know, legitimacy of the movie.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that was one of those things where this would be Bernstein's desk because it's got his bike tire that he drug up.
You know? I see.
Did you, I don't know how much you looked into the trivia of this movie, but
I haven't.
The very opening scene, okay, the movie opens with a typewriter typing out the date, right?
Right.
And it's really powerful, and
it's jarring.
Yeah, to make the audio of the typewriter, they used an actual typewriter. They also used gunshots and a whip crack every time the typewriter ball struck the paper. I mean, when you listen to it with that in mind, it really is a powerful opening for just basically somebody typing. It's not just click, 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 click. It's very, very powerful. And,
wow.
You know, before we even get into the story, think about this. This is like pretty much contemporaneous history. I mean, this was filmed 3 years after Watergate. They started in 75, and Richard Nixon had only been resigned for like a year and a half. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. Especially for the amount of detail they got into, because they actually, you know, they didn't want, the real Ben Bradley didn't want them obviously filming inside the newsroom of the Washington Post, but they allowed them a certain amount of access because they figured, well, they didn't want the guys to be enemies and might as well give them a little bit of access so they can get the detail right. And that way, maybe in the movie, they wouldn't be portrayed poorly. But
good idea.
Yeah. But they created, they ordered a whole bunch of desks from the same company that made the real desks for the newsroom. They also scaled them in such a way, like they took the extras and they organized them by height. And they took the desks and they whittled them down toward the back to create this optical illusion that the place went on for longer. For real.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so...
That's like Orson Welles-esque.
Oh, it's totally. It's amazing. I mean, really, they did the whole nine yards to make it look as big as the actual newsroom without taking that much space. But they tried to procure as many of the original things they could to make it all very authentic. And I'm sure that's where the bike tire came in, because I'm sure when they took a whole bunch of photos, that's what his desk pretty much looked like. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's just great.
Well, and so now I'm looking at the trivia, just to look at the trivia, and there's some interesting things. There's a huge amount of trivia.
Oh yeah. Well, some of it's better than others. You want to start with the plot then?
Sure.
Okay. So, June 1972. A security guard, by the way, the security guard is played by the security guard, the actual guy.
Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, it is totally awesome. So he finds this tape keeping a door from locking properly in the Watergate complex, part of the Watergate Hotel and Business Complex. So apparently in real life, he found the tape, he ripped it off, and then an hour later when he came back on his rounds, he found it taped up again, and that's when he called the police. So he calls the police, who the nearest officers are plainclothes police officers, not or detectives rather, one of which is F. Murray Abraham. And by the way, doing research for this, do you know there's an internet movie guns database where you can look up any movie and find out what make, model, and caliber all the guns in the movie were for?
Get out.
I love the internet for this kind of stuff.
Oh, man.
Yes. I'm sure you can find a blonde toupees in movies internet database, too. Anyway, I love it. So the security guard finds this tape. He calls the police. The police came in and find and arrest five burglars in the Democratic National Committee headquarters within the complex. The next morning, by the way, this is from Wikipedia. The next morning, the Washington Post assigns new reporter Bob Woodward, played by Robert Redford, to the local courthouse to cover the story, which is thought to be of minor importance. So Woodward learns that five men, four Cuban-Americans from Miami, and James W. McCord Jr. had bugging equipment and have their own country club type attorney. So he identifies himself, McCord, I'm sorry, identifies himself in court as having recently left the CIA, and the others also have CIA ties. He connects the burglars to E. Howard Hunt, the former employee of the CIA and President Nixon's special counsel, Charles Colson. So here, what we have is a little minor burglary, but all of a sudden these people have connections to people in real power. And because it's a burglary of the Democratic National Committee, you know, now it's political shenanigans right before an election. And this election had a bunch of shenanigans in it, too.
It did.
I mean, they had the whole thing with Muskie they took out. And then I think McGovern's vice presidential candidate cried or something. And so they made a big deal about his mental health. I mean, the whole thing was pretty underhanded.
Although, well, and then, you know, they make a joke in the newsroom at one point about, you know, how, you know, he's offering the vice presidency to everybody.
Well, yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, maybe it's no different now. I mean, now we have a different players, but I'm sure a lot of it is the same game.
Well, now you have handlers and wranglers, and you have a lot more visibility in certain aspects, but you have a lot more control in other aspects. So, you know, I suspect the shenanigans haven't changed, just their visibility has.
Well, yeah, and you can tell when they go off script, that's when bad things happen to candidates, and fun things happen to people who like to watch the news. So we have basically set up Woodward as a new guy, greenhorn kind of guy, but he's also a dogged reporter. You know, he's asking questions. He's the one who chatted up this attorney who was basically sitting in, but was probably involved in the defense of at least one of these guys. Anyway, these people have ties. He's figured it out through clever means. And so he brings it to the people at the Post. And then Carl Bernstein, who's a veteran reporter. I mean, he's youngish, but he's been doing the reporting gig, he tells us, from age 16. So he treats Woodward as something of a neophyte. So he wants in on the story also. And eventually they're both assigned to the story. So they're reluctant partners. This is a buddy film. They're reluctant partners, but they work well together. So the executive editor of the paper, Ben Bradley, isn't going to be putting stuff in his newspaper that isn't absolutely buttoned down as far as all the pieces have to be linked clearly. And he doesn't think these guys have made enough connections between the people to really put something in the paper about it. So they run some stories, but not on the front page, even though it could be a front page type story. You know, the Republicans or people in the White House, even possibly bugging the Democratic headquarters. But he does encourage them to continue with their work.
Well, I think that at that point, though, they were like, eh, you know, here's your new reporter. You know, it's rumblings, but it's probably nothing. Just like everything else is, you know, little, but probably nothing. And he's eager, but, you know, eagerness doesn't mean story.
Well, and he doesn't run a tabloid newspaper. He runs the Washington Post, which
right.
is second only to the New York Times, but not if you ask them. Their only competition, as far as they see, is the New York Times.
Exactly.
And we find out that Woodward, though, does have something that nobody else has, and that's a contact. A senior government official who, until recently, no one really knew who this person was. This
right.
is
Mark Felt.
Yes, Mark Felt, who was the deputy director of the FBI at the time.
Now, and so, and I know that Woodward confirmed it publicly, but even still, people speculate that he may not have been Deep Throat, even though there's lots of people that say he was. So it's hard to really know the truth. You know, of course, Woodward knows the truth. I don't know why he would lie about it, but also, it's just kind of strange.
Well, up until the minute that Mark Felt, had terminal brain cancer or something and decided to confess on his own, because it was supposed to be, his deal with Woodward is that he would not reveal the source until Felt was dead. But apparently he was terminally ill or something and figured that it wouldn't hurt. But I mean, people thought Pat Buchanan was Deep Throat. So,
well, and some people speculate, I think Ben Stein was Deep Throat. Well, because you know Ben Stein was a huge Nixon. He worked for Nixon.
Yeah, I think did he work in the speechwriting part with Buchanan or? Okay.
He may have. I know that he was on. He was on. He was part of the speechwriting staff. So.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I'm in any further discussion about that would be talking out of my ass, and so I want to try as little of that as possible.
But I mean, the speculation of Deep Throat, it was wide, and of course, you know, it was one of those things where, because you know, a lot of people thought that it was just made up.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, this is a different time in journalism too. I mean, I've never been to journalism school, although if I was to go back to school, I think I would consider it. Because it's something I'm very interested in, maybe only as, say, history, because I don't know how much journalism is going on right now.
Yeah, well, I would speculate almost none.
Well, it seems like these days they're doing things like using, you know, reporters are using other papers as sources instead of developing actual sources.
See, this is, we're headed into the rabbit hole now. This is my rant and rave for months and years now that there is no more journalism. There is entertainment news, and I use the word news only in the lightest, most nearly invisible sense of the word, because reporters don't report anymore. They entertain, and there is bias, and it's clear bias, and there. So it's hard for me to see a lot of journalism, and that may be because most of the prism of journalism I see is the American press, and other countries may be different. I don't know. Not to endorse Al Jazeera, but some of Al Jazeera's news stories are at least, you know, they're fairly clear and unbiased, at least from an American standpoint, which is sometimes a view I appreciate because it's nice to have an outside view. But, news has become entertainment, which has become ratings. And so you don't have people doing news stories for the sake of doing news stories. You have people doing news stories for the sake of trying to win an audience.
Well, exactly. And the newsroom with the major networks, the newsroom was always separate from the entertainment division of the whatever company was in charge. But now they're all the same thing. There is no wall.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, in the days of, you know, Peter Jennings and, you know, Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, where the news division was the news division and wasn't beholden to anybody, let alone commercials.
Yeah, and I'm sure it wasn't perfect. I mean, there's been, I read an article lately about a 60 Minutes producer, a reporter, but also a producer, who resigned because one of his stories got crushed because the head of CBS or the head of the news division of CBS basically didn't like who he was going after as far as a story on corruption of some kind. And so I'm sure that kind of thing happened. But now it just seems like, you know, I mean, look, like local news has often been, we're going to do a local interest story, but it's really basically, we're going to say, hey, you know, here's our restaurant review. But, you know, that's nothing. They're never going to give a negative review. It's always going to be something positive, or they'll cover a store opening or something like it's actual news, when really it's basically an ad.
Yeah, it pains me to watch CNN headline news and turn it on, because you and I have talked many times that we both have had a love in the past with CNN headline news, where now I sometimes turn on CNN headline news just to see what's on and see that there's no news going on. It's a bunch of people talking or commentating, or God forbid, they have some goofy stunts that they're portraying or skit that's going on. News value.
Or yeah, how about the skit called Nancy Grace?
Well, that's CNN. That's the CNN network, CNN proper.
No. Actual... Nancy Grace is on headline news.
Oh, see, I have such a visceral response to her in general that had I seen her, I would have turned the channel, assuming I'd miskeyed the remote.
It's horrible. Horrible.
I can't stand her in any fashion, and I don't know anything about her personally, but as a TV personality, and I say personality, I just keep turning the dial.
Yeah, I'm not a fan. I think she's actually harmful.
I would not disagree with you.
Yeah. So anyway, we learn in the movie that Woodward has this contact, Deep Throat. Now, the movie kind of, you know, Bernstein goes off and does his thing, and he has lots of contacts too. Although in the book describes a little more that, you know, a lot of his contacts are the ladies. So you see a little bit of that in the movie, But in the book, they flesh it out a little bit more. Oh, and incidentally, when Robert Redford, and I found out he bought it for $450,000, so he made his money back, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But he was looking, he wanted to cast himself as Woodward, but he had to find a Bernstein that, you know, he didn't want to make Woodward like a movie star type guy and overshadow Bernstein, so he had to find somebody with as much movie star cred, and that's where Dustin Hoffman comes in.
Which I think was a great choice.
Oh, yeah, it's totally. Both guys do a great, in fact, everybody. I mean, Jack Warden does a great job.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So Hal Holbrook plays Deep Throat, and Hal Holbrook
great,
is awesome.
Another great casting choice.
Oh, yeah. So they have this whole scheme where they meet in an underground parking garage in the middle of the night. And he's really reluctant, Deep Throat is, to confirm anything, but basically says, in the movie, he says, follow the money. Although it's funny, because that phrase is not in the book. That was like a complete tagline of the movie that was actually created by the movie, which is great. I mean, you know, it all works. It's not a fiction. It's just actually coined by the movie, not the book. So then they start connecting the dots on this thing. And the thing about Watergate was the burglary itself was a relatively minor thing. And even the whole diverting of campaign funds and, you know, money being sent to people here and there, that wasn't even a big, huge deal. The deal was lying about it. I mean, that's what got Nixon.
The story wasn't engaged. That they were doing it because it was common practice. The problem is that they lied about it and covered it up.
Well, and also that because of Nixon's tapes, there was proof that he himself had actual knowledge of and he endorsed the actual break-ins, which is crazy. You know, in these days, you would never let, I mean, you would just say, I don't want to know. Fix it. Certainly,
I don't think anybody told Nixon what to do.
Well, no. I'm sure he was a control freak. I mean, the tapes themselves.
You know, his very demeanor. You know, by definition, if the president does it, it is not illegal.
Well, exactly.
Belief.
Yeah. How dare you question his authority?
Right.
So now, one thing there's a tension now, obviously, between Woodward and Bernstein a little bit themselves. Although, again, that's like a buddy cop thing. And
well, except that, I mean, there's some great lines in this movie because the tension starts early because, you know, when Woodward initially starts writing up part of the story, he catches Bernstein, you know, cribbing his notes that he's turning in and rewriting them. And he thinks he sees it, but then he actually confirms it by setting a trap, which is brilliant.
How's it going?
What are you doing?
Polishing.
You what?
Polishing.
What's wrong with it?
Nothing. It's good.
Then what are you doing with it?
I'm just helping. It's a little fuzzy.
May I have it?
I don't think you're saying what you mean.
I know exactly what I mean.
Not here. I can't tell from this whether Hunt works for Coulson or Coulson works for Hunt.
May I have it?
Please tell me the conclusions.
May I have it?
Yes, I'm not looking for a fight.
I'm not looking for a fight either.
I'm just aware of the fact that you've only been here 9 months.
What has that got to do with anything?
Well, I've been in the business since I'm 16.
What are you saying?
Well, I'm trying to tell you that if you'd read mine and then read yours...
May I read yours?
Yeah. I walked by, gave yours a glance, it didn't look right, so I just figured I'd refine it a little. That first paragraph has to have more clarity. The reader's going to understand it. You don't mention Coulson's name to the third paragraph. I think mine's better, but you go ahead and read it. If you think yours is better, we'll give yours to the desk. I've got Coulson's name up front. He was a White House consultant and nobody knows
right.
it.
Yours is better. Do it right. Here are my notes. If you're going to hype it with the facts. I don't mind what you did. I mind the way you did it.
Yep. And he admitted they were better. Bernstein's edits were necessary.
And good, and you know, good for both of them.
Yeah.
But it was hilarious. It's hilarious to see typewriters because, you know, another 30, 40 years, people are going to, you know, if anybody's exposed to this movie new, having known very little about it. Yeah, what the hell is the typewriter? What is that?
Oh, yeah, and all that carbon paper.
Yeah.
And amazing.
Well, the telex.
It's amazing. Just amazing.
But you could tell that the movie was filmed in very... There's one point where Bernstein is interviewing one of the young ladies, and they're on the restaurant that's on the veranda overlooking, and the plane's going overhead,
uh-huh.
and they're like yelling as loud as they can to get their lines in,
which is, I mean, actually, it's funny that that person he was talking to. In my head, I recast her as Daniel Fishel from Boy Meets World, Topanga. That she should play her in the remake.
I don't get the reference. I'm sorry.
You never seen Boy Meets World or
no.
Okay. No. Well, anyway.
Sorry, epic fail.
No, it's okay. I was thinking
on
actually, Bernstein, John Cusack, or maybe Nicolas Cage.
Oh, I see John Cusack. I couldn't sit through Nicolas Cage.
Or you have to open your mind a little bit about this.
James Franco.
No, I can't. I can't. I mean, he would be the obvious choice. I actually thought of him, but I thought, no, I can't. I cannot abide Mr. Franco. How about this? Turn it up a little bit. How about Ray Romano?
I would actually see Robert Downey Jr.
Maybe. I see Ray Romano. I can see it. And who would be Woodward? The only thing I could think of was Brad Pitt.
Luke
Wilson?
Yeah.
Maybe.
It kills me to say that, but
well, Luke Wilson and James Franco could actually probably pull it off.
Yeah.
Yeah, except that I don't know, again, I can't abide James Franco.
Well, I like James Franco.
Actually, you know what? It could be Luke and Owen Wilson.
Oh god. Oh.
It wouldn't be awesome?
Oh, I just threw up on my mouth a little bit. By the way, rotary phone for the typewriters, but also library slips. The other thing that nobody's going to understand.
Exactly. Yeah, library cards. Yeah.
And I actually made a note here. Journalism today, no one would know how to do this.
Oh, that, you know, I wrote a note like, do you remember when doing research was about going to a library and knowing how to look through library material? And that was
card
a whole
catalog.
Art. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
microfiche and retrieving magazines and knowing your Dewey Decimal System, which I don't know that it's taught very much anymore.
And going through phone books and yearbooks and all sorts of weird, like, county records and things instead of Google.
Yeah, and so when they go to the Library of Congress, they go to get the library slips. The cinematography where they're on the rotunda and, you know, the overhead shot that's kind of pulsing back and forth.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I thought it was great. I also liked there are a couple times where they have these panning shots of the newsroom where they run to catch up with Bradley or they're called into Bradley's office where you have these long panning shots and that kind of shows the scope of the newsroom. Oh, those are great too.
There was also a couple touches to this movie, which, and again, I don't know how legitimate these were or if these were just good cinema. But, you know, there's points where Ben Bradley comes to Woodward and Bernstein and sits down at their desks with them.
Yes.
And is going through the article. You know, you don't see that a lot anymore, at least in places where I work. You know, you don't have a lot of the boss coming down to sit with, and granted, I work in a different environment now, but like when I worked in the office, my boss never came to my desk.
Oh, and his feet are always on the desk. His feet are on his own desk, his feet are on other people's desk. And like I said, he is a commanding presence.
Well, and, you know, which is, you know, another great quote, which I hope it was a legitimate quote, but where, I think Bradley shoots them down and Bernstein just loses his shit. And Woodward's like, you know, you think bitching about it is going to get the story where we want it?
Oh, yeah.
It's like so, like, it's so prescient and so just like, boom.
Oh, yeah.
It brings them right back. But yeah, I mean, there's some great, great.
What about Ned Beatty? I love Ned Beatty.
Yeah.
Ned Beatty is a goddamn American treasure.
And again, that's like how much of that subterfuge was actually, how much did Woodward and Bernstein actually have to do that?
No, he did
that.
Yeah.
So with the county clerk and all that?
That whole thing. It was all right from the book.
See, that's what journalists, I doubt, and I'm sure there's exceptions, but I doubt much of that journalistic attitude prevails today.
Yep, I don't, at least I don't see it. You know, I mean, I am a small, tiny part of a government agency, and the government agency releases press releases, and they pretty much print them as they're written.
Yeah.
So there's no digging. And it may be it's impractical, and these days there's so much, it's, you know, your time is so better documented that you can't just go and have a beer with somebody and not have all the rest of your coworkers find out about it, your boss find out about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's what they used to do. Oh, actually, reporters used to show up at police departments and at courthouses and just chit-chat with people. And
you could never have a deep throat today because he would not be able to hide.
I don't know. There are whistleblowers, it's harder.
Not to that degree because, you know, meeting in a parking garage, you know, at 2 a.m. in the morning, that's kind of spooky, attention, but... You know, in this day and age of cell phones and trackability and GPS and, you know, somebody.
I don't know. I mean, the whole, you know, I don't know how much of House of Cards you've seen, but.
I think I'm on like the 12th or 13th episode. I'm almost done with season one.
Yeah. I'm sure people have one phone that's their business phone and one phone that's like a go phone or a throw phone that they just use for nefarious activities.
I know. Now I'm thinking I need a disposable burner phone.
Exactly.
Just to have one like in the closet.
Everybody needs a burner.
So all right, not to tangent too far, but you've made it through House of Cards?
Just the first season. I haven't seen the second season.
So I'm so angry that I had to stop watching. So angry.
Oh yeah. It's a great show.
It is, but I was like, why did you do that? You know what I'm talking about, I'm sure. I don't want to spoil it for everybody.
Well, yeah, of course, yeah.
No, I was just so angry. I was like,
Everything, that is a well-written show.
Absolutely.
Yeah, anyway. But, so, and, you know, there are still leaks in government, I mean, all the time. I mean, I know there are leaks, and then there are, well, that was what the, ostensibly, that was why they were called the plumbers, was to track leaks, to find out who is leaking information from the Nixon White House. So, you know, you plant leaks on purpose to see where they end up. You plant, like, false stories or stories that have a little bit of false information to see kind of where they crop up, and that way you kind of know, depending on who you told that to.
Yeah.
You know, of course, that's, again... That's the the really good speech from Leo in The West Wing when he finds out one of the interns. I'm talking about like the balding guy that's old, dark hair.
Oh, the Toby Ziegler character.
Yes, yeah, Toby. Okay, yeah.
Okay.
No, Toby actually calls all the interns into the kitchen, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he has a really good speech about that. But as far as like leaks, yeah, I'm sure that kind of stuff still happens.
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know, and without divulging too much about my job, no, there have been, you know, I work for the county, and there have been leaks in the county that have gone to the press. Now, luckily, it's not my department, so it's not something I'm responsible for, like, knock on wood. But clearly there's still whistleblowers, so I guess I will see the point to you on that. Because last year we had a city council and that resigned after having an affair. He's married, of course, having an affair with somebody else who worked for the county, who has since also resigned. So
yeah, well, and you know, to when one person's whistleblower is another person's traitor, it's the whole freedom fighter right. versus terrorist.
Well, you know, history is written by the victors.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, it's hard to know what right and wrong sometimes is in certain. Although in this. And going back to this movie, you know very clearly what right and wrong is.
Well, the nice thing about this movie is that, again, this is a movie about the reporters, but their subjects, you can really tell, you know, even Meredith Baxter Birney, you can tell, I'm sorry, Meredith Baxter at this point, You know, these are actual just people who have a job that have, you know, you get along to go along in your job normally. I mean, everybody pretty much does. But when things start to stink, if you don't have a way to find another job, you just do what people, you know, you do what your boss tells you, and you try not to, you know, try to hold your nose. So now that, you know, they start talking to people about crooked stuff that's going on, you know, everybody has like their conscience, you know, they want to deny or avoid. But then you get people who have to, you know, just have to, for their own conscience, tell somebody, yes, I didn't like this. I didn't want to be a part of this. And this is what I know, or this is what I'm comfortable telling you because, you know, I don't want to be, well, fill in the blank, could be anything.
Right.
People are worried about getting killed.
And then it's hard to know, during that time and place, if Woodward and Bernstein, how much danger that they were actually in, if it really could have risen to the level of them, their lives being in danger. You certainly could see how it could easily have escalated to that, especially, in, you know, hindsight, looking at Nixon's batshit crazy ability to convince himself of anything, really.
Well, all the rest of the people involved in that, Liddy, you know, you read Liddy's book, Will, which is actually worth reading. He tells that same story about holding his hand over the candle flame until he could smell burning flesh.
Which is one of the greatest lines in the movie.
Oh, yeah. And at least according to Liddy, it's absolutely true. He talks about it in his book. But all of these guys, I mean, you get the sense that he would have killed these guys if the president had told him to. He's just part of his, you know, covert operation. He was a covert operator.
That's really chilling.
It is. But, you know, sometimes, again, it's that whole, you can't handle the truth, you know? So, here's back to the movie. So, Ben Bradley keeps saying, you need to have more sources. You need to confirm these things because we are not going to put our reputation at stake over, like, with a faulty foundation. So, you need to do your work.
And you can, you know, it's clear from the frustration of everybody that, you know, because he, you know, he, in the movie, he's screaming, when does somebody go on the goddamn record in the story?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, because this is a trend, actually, apparently, is using unnamed sources and that kind of stuff. So,
I think the point is not, the point is lost, at least to me, that this is a town about politics, full of politicians and press that kind of have a symbiotic relationship. Nobody wants to go on the record because nobody wants to lose their job or their contact.
Well, exactly.
So they want to, you know, many of them want to do the right thing and say the right thing and be the righteous, but they don't want to do it at too much of the expense of their careers and their livelihood.
Well, exactly. And it's not like these people are pipe fitters. You know, if they lose their job and a lot of their job involves being able to do things, you know, in politics, well, if you burn that bridge or show yourself as being not loyal, who else is going to hire you in that job? You got to actually learn a whole different skill at that point. So it's a serious deal. Yeah, you just can't pack up and move to Peoria and be a speechwriter for, you know, a senator at that point.
And if you're a journalist, again, a journalist euphemistically at this point, you know, your words still mean something.
Oh, of course.
Your reputation is probably everything.
Yeah, and you should actually, if you print what turns out to be not the truth, I mean, I'm not saying you print a lie on purpose, but if you print something that's not the truth, you should feel bad about that. Besides having to print a retraction, you should feel like you're not a good reporter at that point. And at this point, I just think it seems like, you know, got this one wrong. Oh, well, move on to the next thing. But the way that Ben Bradley determines that there's more, that there is still something to the story, and not just Ben Bradley, but also Jack Warden and all the rest of the people, is that when the White House issues their non-denial, which since seeing this movie is something, you know, I've looked for, when you listen to like the president's reaction to something or somebody's reaction to a scandal, you want to listen to what they're saying and actual facts that they are saying or actual positions instead of just, you know, I'm sorry if someone was offended, you know, not admitting anything, not talking about the actual story. You know, it's the whole Anthony Weiner thing.
Well, they're talking around the issue, and they're not talking about the issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which brings up another West Wingism, you know, where one of my, you know, on the West Wing, one of my favorite characters, the Danny Kincannon character of the zoo is who is a reporter who is constantly, you know, annoying C.J. Craig in the White House, where, you know, he will ask a question and the president will answer it, and he would retort with, well, I'm sure, you know, that's an answer to a question, but it's not an answer to the question that I asked.
Exactly. Exactly. So the non-denial denial let them know that, oh, yeah, there is still something to this. We're not going to let this go, because the fact that they did not categorically deny this means there's something there. There must
right.
be something
they're not,
true.
They're not calling them. They're not telling me. They're not telling us that they're wrong. They're just saying, you know, they're blowing smoke. Well, there's probably fire somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's well known that Ben Bradley is not a supporter of this candidate or whatever. Like, yeah, okay. That is a statement, but it has nothing necessarily to do with the claims that are being made against you.
Right. It's just a way to detract. It's like, you know, look over here. Something shiny.
Yeah. Well, and I love the fact that at this point we meet with Deep Throat again, and that's where, you know, that's where you get the sense of tension where Deep Throat says, you people are in danger, in actual danger. So you have to be careful. And where,
which is where Woodward, you know, it's like, you know, stop dicking me around.
Exactly.
Just take a stand and tell me, or don't. But don't, you know, don't come down on me because I get it wrong when you're deliberately not feeding me information. You're feeding me misinformation.
Well, and when he leaves that meeting, or when the car in the garage, you know, peels out and Deep Throat disappears, and now he's got to basically like walk home or walk to find a cab. Yeah, you get the sense that he is afraid, and you don't know whether it's paranoia or reality, but it doesn't actually matter.
No, it doesn't matter at all. Which is, you know, I said, you know, very much so that, you know, when I first saw this movie, it scared me.
Oh, yeah.
Because I expected something bad to happen.
Yeah. Well, and when they show up at Bradley's house in the middle of the night, and Bradley comes outside in his robe.
Yeah.
It's really well done in the fact that he's like, oh, why are these guys, these young guys out here dragging me out here? And fine, whatever. But then instead of telling him to, you know, I mean, you expect him to say, okay, we'll deal with this later or whatever, or you're over, you know, you're exaggerating or whatever. Instead, he says, okay, you need to go and get a nice rest and a shower, say 15 minutes, and then go back to work. And that's where pretty much the movie ends.
There's no payoff.
That's the climax of the movie, where Ben Bradley says, okay, now you've hit it. Now you know the fact that you were in trouble means you have something. So now go get it. And the last thing you see is Woodward and Bernstein just typing their little hearts out at their news desks in the middle of the night. And as the next shift comes on and the newsroom fills up, and in the background, or on a TV, actually, in the foreground, when they're in the background, you see the Nixon taking the oath of office, and then his, like the 21-gun salute, the cannons going off.
Yeah.
Which is a callback to the beginning with the typewriter smashing down, because they show the teletype of all of kind of what happened then next over all of the cannon fire.
The House of Cards, if you will, coming down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing because, like I said, this is a movie with really very little action at all. It's all just people talking, and a lot of it, there's like 23 different phone conversations that you hear both sides of.
Which is cool.
Yeah, super cool. And like I said, the pace of this movie is perfect. You know, for a movie with no real action, this is absolutely the best paced movie I've seen in a long time.
I would agree.
In the trivia, I guess the two lead actors memorized each other's lines so that they could both interrupt each other in character, which I guess was disconcerting for the other actors. But which was
worked
nice.
Very well, though.
Well, because that way you got their true reaction, you know, the looks on their face when they're in the same scene with the Woodward and Bernstein was actually, you know, genuine.
Well, and the part where Woodward's on the phone with the two phone lines and he's jockeying back and forth with the two people he's interviewing on the phone. You know, in the trivia, it talks of, which I didn't know, it talks about how that, you know, that's a single take and that, you know, he flubbed his line, but he covered it so well that it added some believability to the character.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It totally made
It made it seem more realistic because, you know, he was, you know, they're all tense, they're all tired, they're all overworked. You know, they're chasing something that everybody's telling them is fake.
And did you see the trivia that scene where Kenneth Dahlberg tells Bob Woodward on the phone, look, I've just been through a terrible ordeal. My neighbor's wife has been kidnapped. Yeah, that's all true.
Which is true.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's like crazy.
The wife of a prominent businessman and the friend of the Dahlberg family is kidnapped and released 2 days later after the husband paid $1 million in ransom.
Yeah.
Again, this is Minnesota. This is Fargo.
Who needs $1 million in Minnesota?
No, remember Fargo?
I have never seen Fargo.
You've never seen Fargo?
I've never seen Fargo.
Oh, you need to see Fargo at some point.
I know I need to. It's on the list of things I need to see, but no, I just haven't.
Yeah. I don't want to play it up too much because, you know, then you won't see it. I suggest you watch it before you try to watch the TV series, which I've heard is very good, but the pilot not so good, apparently.
One of my friends at work, Alice, said it was really good. So
yeah.
And I've been trading back and forth with him because I got him hooked on Orange is the New Black.
Which I have yet to see, but it is on my list as well.
It's so good. So good. I binge-watched it last weekend to get through first season. I have a hard time finishing a series if I know that there's not more to watch. I kind of pace myself, which is why I haven't quite finished the first season of House of Cards, because I know there's a second season, and I don't want to race through it. But I love that Netflix puts them all out at once. So
have you heard of the series The Bridge?
I've seen, I think, an ad for it, but I watched the ad, and I think I told Derek, like, after watching the ad, I'm like, I have no idea what this show's about after having watched the ad.
Well, apparently it's, and I just got the first two discs from Netflix, so I'll let you know what the series is like, but apparently it's on the bridge between El Paso and Juarez, Mexico.
Okay.
They find a murder victim. And the murder victim is laying, like, exactly in the middle of the bridge.
Okay.
And then they find out that it's two separate bodies. The American the half of the American body is on the Mexican side, and the Mexican body is on the American side. So the detective in charge of the investigation in El Paso has to work with the detective in charge, I guess, in Juarez. And at first they write it off as just another Juarez killing, but it turns out to be something a little more deep. So, apparently, it's two investigations in one. So, I'll let you know how it goes.
All right.
I think it was patterned after, I want to say it was, like, Israel-Palestine, but it could have been another bridge in another country, because I also want to say it's Norwegian, but maybe not. Anyway, it's a remake of something else, or a reimagining of a different project from overseas.
Which we do a lot of that here in America, where we can't have, you know, we can't use their series. We have to make our own off of their premise, a la Wilfred, a la The Killing.
We've done it forever, though. Because, you know, Sanford and Son is all based off the UK show Steptoe and Son.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, there's a ton of them like that. It's amazing. Anyway, you think that goes the other way? Because things like Friends and stuff were really big in the UK. But no, it's gone the other way, too.
Oh. Ugh, Friends. Ugh. For those of you playing the home game, if you were a fan of The Killing, Season 4 is on Netflix, or going to be soon. Netflix bought it and is publishing it, or producing it, or whatever you want to call it. And I loved The Killing the first season, up until the point where they just shit the bed.
Well, and I didn't. I only saw the first, I think, 4 episodes of it.
Yeah.
And then I got behind, and then I heard that people were angry because instead of ending in one season like they wanted to originally,
well,
it got picked up.
They said that they would resolve the story and that it would be one season for the story. But they did kind of resolve the story. They didn't give you the payoff of who the killer was at the end of the first story, and that's why people got mad. And I don't disagree that they didn't quite do what they said, except that you had to expect that they were going to try and continue the show. So I have mixed feelings about it. But the second season kind of lost me. And then by the end of the third season, I was like, are you kidding? Like, are you kidding? But I'll go watch the fourth season because I'm a completionist. I can't not, but the first season, the first season into the second season, it is really good and really worth it.
Okay, well, I'll have to. I will have.
But
to
I wouldn't. I wouldn't. Yeah, I wouldn't. I wouldn't bend over backwards and clear my DVR or clear my viewing schedule just to watch that. Just all by it. It's a little lonesome, but you know, if you want to hanker in to kind of finish the story, it was well done.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was very well acted. The show that I saw, you know, the first four episodes or whatever. And it had a very, very dark feel to it, very gritty.
Well, it looked like Seattle. I mean, you know, it looked like Seattle. It really did look just like it. So, and granted, I haven't lived in Seattle, but I've been there plenty. And, you know, but it has a certain good, very recreative effect. So,
well, they used the omnipresent rain as to set the whole tone for the thing.
Yeah.
The fact that it's always overcast and rainy. It's not just good for vampire movies anymore. It's a real tone setter for that whole series.
Are you making like a Twilight reference?
I am.
Another movies I've never seen.
Yeah, well, it's, you're not missing anything. They're fine. Yeah. Actually, it turns out they're fine. They're just not, it's not a great story, and it's certainly not a great, it's not a very empowering, like, feminism kind of role. But, you know, it is what it is. It's probably perfectly entertaining.
Teeny bot movies.
Yep, although there's a cheat in the last one. You know what? It's a cheat I'm going to give away, too.
Uh-oh.
So you end up with three movies where they talk about, you know, there's a little bit of fighting in the three movies, but not a ton, and it's all sort of dance fighting, kind of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon style, and it's more love story than it is fighting, until you get to the fourth movie. And then the fourth movie, people are decapitated right and left, because that's how you can kill them. All these people die, and then it's a fucking dream sequence. I mean, you're really getting into it because people are dying. It's like, yeah, I wanted him to die in the beginning because it's a stupid character. And then it's like, oh no, this is what it would have been if you didn't take this path. It's like, get the fuck out. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not regretting my decision.
So, anyway, anything else about All the President's Men? I highly recommend both the book and the movie.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have to go read the book. The movie is still great. It's still watchable. It made me actually, though, embarrassingly for myself to have to admit, I had to go and look up because I asked Derek. I'm like, when Nixon was at the second inaugural? I'm like, do they do that? Did they have second inaugurals? Because I never remember, like, I don't remember Reagan's second inaugural, and I didn't remember Clinton's second inaugural, and I, you know, shamefully didn't remember Obama's second inaugural, but I went and looked. I'm like, oh, I guess they did. Cause, you know, they have the TV footage at the end of the movie of Nixon's second inaugural and swearing in. And I was like, I don't think
yeah,
they did
that.
Yeah,
do they swear him in the second time? But yep.
I'm a little bit smarter now than I was before, for as long as I will retain that knowledge.
I'm trying to find
it. So until tomorrow, really.
Exactly. That's what he said.
Or until this is released and I listen to it again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Dead Again, coming out probably tomorrow.
And what, awesome. And I've listened to you and Drew talking about, what was the last one you released?
It was Contact, and then before that, it was Nightbreed.
Nightbreed, yeah. Boy, hilarious. You two are funny.
In what way? Do tell.
Well, it's just amusing to listen to you because you come at it with this enthusiastic, glassy-eyed kind of teenager horror movie. Just you suspend all of your criticality, if you will, which is probably not even the appropriate term.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right.
But Drew goes and he's like, I like this. Or I thought I did, and now it's just awful.
Oh, yeah. No.
Which again, I think you and I discovered to some degree with other movies we watched, not to spoil anything. But.
Oh, yeah. No, it's funny because I don't mind having my opinion change during the course of the podcast. But like with Nightbreed, I so wanted to like it. And even when I watched it again for the podcast, I'm like, oh, this is not good anymore. I mean, this has horrible problems, and but okay, there must be something to it. But
well, you said it's not good anymore. So was it good?
No,
or was it just bad and you didn't realize it?
Well, there was a little bit of 2001 in there because I had read this. I had read the book, the novella that it was
based on. Back to the 2001.
We can't get away from 2001. But,
my God.
But it was that effect. Is that? But although I reread the book or re-listened to the book also, and it's not a great book either. It's got some real problems to it. Although it's funny because, you know, delving into like the subplot or not subplot, but like the whole gay angle never
yeah,
even.
Yeah, the consummated gay relationship, which made me a little uncomfortable having my little brother discuss this. And I'm like, no, I don't want to hear this.
Well, it was so funny because at the time, you know, it never occurred to me that Clive Barker was gay. Although it wasn't long after I read the novel that I guess he came out. Although, look, reading his stories, there's lots of, you know, that kind of theme in there. And so it makes total sense, you know. And it doesn't take anything away or really add anything either, as far as I'm concerned, to the stories themselves. But it just hadn't until Drew's like, yeah, did you get that last part? Because if not, I'm going to explain it to you.
I was laughing in the car.
So. Excellent. That's what I want. Oh, another piece of trivia. You're a car guy. I wondered what the car was that Bob Woodward was driving.
It was a Volvo, wasn't it?
Volvo Amazon.
Yeah, I knew it was a Volvo. Yeah. I just didn't know it. But the shots, the cinematography, like where they're pulling out of the parking garage, made me laugh because I'm like, oh, people park like dicks even then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Although, they're not very pedestrian friendly.
You know, and this is back where, you know, they didn't have all those barriers in front of the White House. You know, all that 9/11 stuff.
Right.
So, never forget. It shouldn't be laughing at 9/11, but. Every time I say 9/11, I have to say never forget, even if when I'm talking about 911.
Good to know.
Someday I want to answer the phone. 911, never forget. What's the location of your emergency?
Ooh, I think that would end badly.
That'd be my last day. I would never really do it, because I don't want to give people the wrong idea. Although I did tell you at the time where I, 4 years. It took me 4 years to make this mistake, and it came back to bite me, but I was reading a magazine after working at my present employment for 4 years, and the phone rang, and I answered the phone. And because for the 8 years previous to my 4 years at this new job, I had been a phone operator, I answered the phone, "Good afternoon, Hotel Captain Cook."
Oh, dear.
Yes. But it wasn't 911. It was a business line. But the lady that answered is like, "Hi, Captain. My name is blah, 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 and I've got this police problem." So I said, "Well, most certainly. Let me connect you with who can help you with your police problem." So she didn't even know, okay?
You were Captain Cook.
Exactly. She thought I was Captain Cook, which is fine. Actually, it turns out we do have a Captain Cook. It's a whole different story. But that would have been the end of it. And I told my buddy Connie, and that was it.
Yeah.
Except that about a month afterward, there was a complaint about whether or not a tow truck was called or something. It had to do with, you know, money. Somebody was complaining that the call, the tow was never called or was never canceled.
Recommended somebody or something.
No. It was more like we were supposed to call, but we didn't, or we were supposed to call to cancel, but we didn't. And then they were claiming that we owed the money or something. And it was all a tow company complaint with the contract that we have with tow companies. So my supervisor, Debbie, had to listen to like basically an entire shift's worth of phone calls to see if this call had ever been made. So she was listening to everybody's phone calls, and the phone recorder playback machine thing was sort of in the middle of the room, and I had a recruit. And so I had a long cord, and I was like standing way behind my recruit, giving her a little space. And all of a sudden Debbie, who has been on this call recorder thing with headphones on all day, she pulls up her headphones and says, "Eric." And I'm like, "What?" Cause I know I did something, you know, cause it's a day, so I probably did something to offend somebody.
that
she,
tone.
Yeah. So I'm like, what? She goes, hold on. And she unplugs the headphones and she turns up the volume and she says, everybody, gather round.
Oh, no.
Good afternoon, Hotel Captain Cook. This is Eric. Brrr. Good afternoon, Hotel Captain Cook. This is Eric. Brrr. Good afternoon, Hotel Captain Cook. This is Eric. Yeah.
Oh.
It was both hilarious and mortifying. Yes, exactly.
So. I feel for you because I have answered at county. I have answered once, maybe twice, but I think only once. Fred Meyer Pharmacy, and of course, I get looks from my coworkers like, "Oh God, did that just really come out of my mouth?"
Oh, yeah. Well, I've never read a magazine. Just like kick back, like Ben Bradley with my feet on the desk reading a magazine. That never happened again. Yeah. 14 more years later, it never happened again.
Well, and like I think at home I've answered. There have been times at home where I answered, Fred Meyer, or County, we have such a weird, we almost never get phone calls at county because we just don't have staff to answer the phone. I wish that we had more staff, but
you don't necessarily want phone calls either.
But that, well, we're reliant on voicemail because we service so many people that a lot of people call. We have to triage. We can't answer the phone constantly because I wouldn't be able to get any work done. So the unfortunate, the technology has helped and hindered us. Going forward, hopefully, knock on wood, we will have a better interactive voice response system. But since we're nonprofit, we require money for that. So I think it's in the budget, but budget requires time and resource. So
cross
our fingers.
That's an interesting point that I will apply to another part of my job that I won't talk about on the podcast. The fact that you use the voicemail to triage. Because that could explain something that's irritated me for a long time. But if you look at it in that light, it makes some sense. So I think I am going, whether it's true or not in this case that I'm thinking about, I think I'm going to think that it's true to make myself feel better.
Well, I think a lot of people, now that we're not talking about the movie, I think a lot of people misunderstand that, my not answering the phone and them getting voicemail is not me punishing them. It's that I don't have the ability to answer the phone because there's only four texts and we have three windows. And so at any point in the day, there's a tech at each window and then one tech is filling prescriptions out the window. So I don't have staffing to be able to do all of that, service all the customers and answer the phone. If you leave me a message, I can triage what I need to do, and I can call you back when I can get a Slack moment. But if I had to answer the phone every time somebody called in, I would get nothing accomplished. I would spend all day, probably from start to finish, on the phone. We're hoping for an interactive voice response system, which will alleviate some of that, which will then enable me, hopefully, to be more responsive. But as we know, technology often doesn't actually make things better. It just makes things more complicated.
Well, like I said, I think I'm going to take that whole triage thought process and use it to make myself feel better.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I could brighten your day just a little bit.
No, you may brighten my whole rest of my career. Because looking at it through that lens makes that. I might actually explain it to somebody else using that lens.
Oh, hey. Yeah. More power to you.
So
I'm glad I could spread the gospel of my phone system. And by the way, we have a new phone system, which I don't know how to use, and I am unhappy about that. So
phone systems are the devil. Bobby Boucher. So anything else about All the President's Men?
No.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad we got to talk about it. It was fun.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. As always, send feedback to show@notinacreepyway.com. Please subscribe to us on iTunes. Hey, write a review. Give us 5 stars. We'd appreciate it. You can also listen on Stitcher Radio. If you have a suggestion for a movie for us to talk about, send it to movie@notinacreepyway.com. We like feedback. We want to hear from you.